From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The death of Zarqawi does not relieve me or bring me any comfort. It saddens me. His death is doubly tragic. Not only does he have loved ones who will be suffering the same grief that I and my family have suffered over the last 2 years, but he's a political figure, and his death will rekindle, inflame the insurgency. It will be another step in the endless cycle of revenge, a volleyball game between George Bush and Zarqawi, or his replacement.
Michael Berg's son, Nicholas Berg, was killed in Iraq 2 years ago. It's believed he was beheaded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Michael Berg is now running for Congress. We'll talk to him. Then the telecoms COPE bill that could end net neutrality passes in the House. And Israel assassinates the senior member of the Hamas government. We'll speak with a Palestinian journalist and mother who lives in Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Shortly after announcing he'd been killed in an airstrike, the U.S. military displayed images Thursday of the body of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, Iraq's most wanted man. The pictures showed Zarqawi with visible cuts and bruises to his face. The Iraqi and U.S. government say Zarqawi was killed when U.S. fighter planes dropped a pair of 500-pound bombs on a safe house outside the town of Baquba. To many, Zarqawi was the face of the Iraqi resistance. He was accused of carrying out countless bombings, murders, and other acts of violence, including the beheading of hostages in Iraq. In Washington, President Bush hailed Zarqawi's death.
Zarqawi is dead. But the difficult and necessary mission in Iraq continues. We can expect the terrorists and insurgents to carry on without him. We can expect the sectarian violence to continue. Yet the ideology of terror has lost one of its most visible and aggressive leaders. Zarqawi's death is a severe blow to al-Qaeda. It's a victory in the global war on terror. And it is an opportunity for Iraq's new government to turn the tide of this struggle.
News of Zarqawi's death was also welcomed by many Iraqis. This is Imad Kadim, a resident of Baghdad.
Zarqawi's death means a chance for us to get rid of terrorism, God willing, because he is a malicious man, a spiteful person who has no religion and no conscience. He hurts our people. We hope that peace and goodwill prevail, and that people go back to their jobs, and that those who traveled abroad are returned to their families. The country has had enough from Zarqawi and his colleagues.
Minutes after Zarqawi's death was announced, the Iraq government said it had finally agreed on appointees to fill positions in charge of interior defense and national security. Meanwhile, at least 31 people were killed Thursday in three separate bombings across Iraq. In the day's worst violence, 13 people were killed in an attack at a Baghdad fruit market. The Iraqi government has imposed a daytime vehicle ban in Baghdad in anticipation of violent retaliation for Zarqawi's death. Meanwhile, lawmakers have finalized a budget agreement that will provide $65.8 billion for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The budget agreement comes as a new poll shows a record 59% of Americans believe going to war against Iraq was a mistake. In the occupied territories, an Israeli airstrike has killed a senior member of the Hamas government and three bodyguards Thursday. The government official, Interior Ministry General Director Jamal Abu Samhadana, was also a member of the Popular Resistance Committees. He'd been accused of plotting attacks inside Israel. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has canceled international talks that were expected to lead to emergency payments of salaries for Palestinian workers. Thousands of Palestinian government employees have gone without pay following an international aid freeze on the Hamas-led government. A European diplomat told the Independent of London the cancellation is stoking fears the U.S. government is committed to regime change in the occupied territories. In Bolivia, the government's plan to redistribute thousands of acres of seized land is being resisted by landowners. This week, landowners in Santa Cruz burnt down the homes of peasants who'd come to occupy seized land. This is landowner Luis Del Rio.
The houses that we burned were a consequence of the eviction of the Guarayos. We hope that there is nothing left here of these houses. This is a field where we have harvested soy. They have come to a farm field. This is not free countryside.
The government has vowed to continue with the land distribution. This is Bolivian President Evo Morales.
I am starting to get to know the true businessmen who invest in their country, who export. Those businessmen never make problems for us. They just ask us to guarantee markets outside the country. And there are other businessmen threatening, intimidating, talking of taking up arms when we talk of the land. The land has to be distributed, my companions. The land cannot continue in the hands of a few, and there are many hands left without the land.
Bolivian President Evo Morales. The CIA's covert operation to finance Somali warlords fighting against Islamic militants is coming under harsh internal criticism. According to the New York Times, several U.S. government officials say the operation has backfired and empowered the Islamic groups it intends to weaken. According to the officials, agents have funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars directly into the warlords' hands from the CIA station in Nairobi, Kenya. The State Department's political officer was reassigned to Chad after he sent a cable criticizing the operation. Critics say the payments have motivated Islamic militants to launch preemptive attacks against expected U.S.-backed offensives. The revelation comes at a time of increased fighting between the two sides. This week, Islamic militias announced they've seized control of the capital of Mogadishu. The warlords had controlled the city for the past 15 years. On Capitol Hill, a bill to hand over limited self-governance to Native Hawaiians failed to advance in the Senate Thursday, effectively ending its hopes for this session of Congress. The Native Hawaiian Government Reorganization Act would have granted 400,000 people of Native Hawaiian ancestry a new role in overseeing resources and lands on the Hawaiian Islands. Supporters of the bill said it was necessary to redress injustices stemming from the U.S. government's overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1893. Thursday's vote came a day after two dozen Native Hawaiian activists occupied the second floor of Iolani Palace, the historic monarchical residence of Honolulu's capital district. The activists chanted, sang, waved signs, and hung upside-down state flags. The demonstrators said Congress has failed to grant the issue of Hawaiian self-government adequate attention. Several also said they opposed the Senate bill because it did not grant Native Hawaiians enough independence from the U.S. government. In another vote on Thursday, the Senate rejected a measure to eliminate the estate tax. The vote marks a significant defeat for the Bush administration and several leading Republicans. A study carried out by the Joint Committee on Taxation had estimated the cost of repealing the estate tax could have topped $1 trillion. Meanwhile, in the House, lawmakers passed the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act, known as the COPE bill. The controversial telecommunications legislation would permit phone and cable companies to operate internet and other digital communication service as private networks, free of policy safeguards or governmental oversight. The bill would effectively end what is known as net neutrality, which is the concept that everyone everywhere should have free, universal, and non-discriminatory access to the internet. The bill would also cut back the obligation of cable TV companies to devote channels to public access and fund the facilities to run them. And the COPE bill would replace local cable franchises with national franchises. We'll have more on this later in the program. In Virginia, the state Supreme Court ordered a new trial Thursday for a convict who had been sent to death row after jurors ruled he's not mentally retarded. The prisoner, Darrell Atkins, was convicted of robbing and shooting a U.S. Air Force pilot in 1996. Atkins' case drew headlines 4 years ago when the Supreme Court ruled in his favor that executing mentally retarded people is unconstitutionally cruel. And in another death row case in the state, Virginia Governor Timothy Kaine delayed the execution of a convicted killer just hours before he was to be put to death. The prisoner, Percy Walton, was given a 6-month reprieve to allow an independent evaluation of his mental condition. In Ohio, the state's top electoral official is being accused of trying to fix the upcoming November elections. Democrats and voter registration groups charge Secretary of State Ken Blackwell has drafted draconian rules that could easily lead to penalties against people who register voters. The Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, known as ACORN, says the rules are so vague the group has cut back its voter registration efforts while lawyers review the new guidelines. Democrats say Blackwell is attempting to prevent Black, low-income, and Democratic voters from voting in his upcoming gubernatorial race against Democratic Congressmember Ted Strickland. And Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader indicted on corruption charges, officially retires from Congress today. DeLay bid farewell Thursday with a defiant speech on the House floor. In his 22-minute address, DeLay attacked liberalism and defended partisanship. In closing, he said, quote, "I exit, as always, stage right." DeLay resigned in April following months of political turmoil that included his criminal indictment, corruption probes, and guilty pleas by two key members of his staff. DeLay's speech came on the same day. An independent study said his former chief of staff, Susan Hirschman, was one of the two top recipients of privately funded travel among congressional staff over a five-year period. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to Iraq and the reported killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The Iraqi and U.S. governments say he was killed Wednesday when U.S. fighter planes dropped a pair of 500-pound bombs on a safe house outside the town of Bakuba. To many, Zarqawi was the face of the Iraqi resistance. He was accused of carrying out countless bombings, murders, and other acts of violence, including the beheading of hostages in Iraq. CIA officials said it was probably Zarqawi himself who beheaded Nicholas Berg, the 26-year-old American who died in May of 2004. A graphic video showing the beheading appeared on the internet. In the video, his captors read a statement denouncing the abuse of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. U.S. military officials found Berg's body on May 8, 2004, just 2 weeks after 60 Minutes first broadcast images of the U.S. abuse at Abu Ghraib. To talk about the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, we're joined in Wilmington, Delaware, by Michael Berg. He's the father of Nicholas Berg. Since his son's death, Michael has become a vocal critic of the Iraq War and the Bush administration. Now he's running for Congress in Delaware on the Green Party ticket. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Michael Berg.
Thank you.
Can you first share your reaction to the reported death of Zarqawi?
Well, I was not relieved, not comforted by his death. In fact, I was saddened by his death, as I am about any human's death. Zarqawi is not the only one that died if 1,000 pounds of bombs were exploded there. Aside from being a human being and having people that love him that will suffer the same pain that my family and I have suffered, Zarqawi is a political figure. He and George Bush have been playing a volleyball game of revenge for too long now, and this is just another spike in that volleyball game. And it will bring about only more death, more sadness, and it will perpetuate this endless cycle of revenge.
Michael Berg, do you believe that Zarqawi beheaded your son personally?
I don't know. And I say that because I have been lied to so many times by the FBI, the State Department, and by George Bush. We've all been lied to by George Bush, that I neither believe nor disbelieve anything that I hear they said or that I hear them say. So I really don't know. I don't even know if Zarqawi was alive at that time or whether he's been dead for a long time, whether he ever existed.
Why do you have these questions?
Again, because I've been lied to so many times. I don't believe anything the American government says. I don't believe anything the FBI says. I don't believe anything the State Department says because I have been lied to by them. The FBI came to my house on March 31st and said, "We have your son." On May the 11th, they denied they have my son. The State Department sent me an email. I still have the original email saying, "Your son is being held in a military prison in Iraq." A couple days later, they said, a couple weeks later, they said that was wrong, that he wasn't held in a military prison. George Bush lied to us about weapons of mass destruction. He lied to us about al-Qaeda presence in Iraq before he destabilized the country. And he lied to us about Iraqi involvement in 9-1-1. How can I believe anything that any of these people say? The whole thing can be orchestrated. Maybe many people are Zarqawi. Maybe not. I don't believe, nor do I disbelieve.
Michael Berg, if you could go back to that time, because I think for a lot of people this is perhaps new information. Explain why Nicholas went to Iraq and then the course of what happened in those months in March and April of exactly what you understood.
Okay. My son Nick went to Iraq. He actually went twice during his second trip, and he went there because he believed in the policies of George Bush and because he wanted to help rebuilding the infrastructure of Iraq. He worked on communications towers. He went there legally with all the permits that are required to have, visas, passports, everything that he was required to have. He left on his second trip on March 14th. On March 24th, he was arrested by the Iraqi police just because he was suspicious. He was suspicious because he was an American that was traveling alone, not with a Halliburton or Bechtel convoy, not with the American military. And he was immediately turned over to the American military police in Mosul. These police, namely Lieutenant Colonel William Kern, decided all on his own that, yes, Nick was suspicious and he would be held for FBI questioning. The FBI questioned him for 13 days. They deprived him of his right to due process. They wouldn't let him call home and tell his parents, I'm okay, I'm not dead. They wouldn't let him have a lawyer. They put him in with Iraqi insurgents who wanted to kill him. Finally, I filed a writ of habeas corpus on April the 5th, and he was released the next day. But in the meantime, the events that took place in the Abu Ghraib prison had been revealed and had so inflamed the resistance in Iraq, events happening in Fallujah particularly, and he was in Fallujah when he was abducted later on, that Nick could never get home again.
We're talking to Michael Berg, father of Nicholas Berg, who was captured and beheaded in Iraq in May of 2004. Now, Michael Berg, you are running for Congress on the Green Party ticket from Delaware. Why?
That's right. Well, when Nick died, I mean, I have been a war resister since 1965, but when Nick died, I took responsibility for the war. That is, I dedicated every moment of my life to doing whatever I can do to ending the war. And the opportunity to run on the Green Party ticket, the Green Party that is the only party that says bring the troops home now, today, as part of its platform, that opportunity seemed to me to be an extension of my ability to speak out against the war. And so that's why I did it.
Why didn't you choose to run within the Democratic Party in Delaware?
Because I am not in favor of continuing the war for 6 months or for unlimited time until certain conditions are met. Every 12 minutes, someone dies. Any plan to end the war in more than 12 minutes from right now is irresponsible and immoral. And I don't think that any of our politicians, Joe Biden here in Delaware or Murtha or any of them, have the right to say, well, we can stand the war this much longer. No, we can't.
And how do you respond to those who'll say that Iraq will descend into a civil war if U.S. soldiers pull out immediately?
I would ask them to open their eyes and to look at the civil war and the chaos that's going on now. Look at the massacres of people every day that are going on now. How many people died when those bombs fell that got Zarqawi? How many people have died since Zarqawi was killed just in retaliation for his death? We're losing ground in Iraq every day. Baghdad is totally out of our control. Except for the green zone. And it's going to be far worse if we wait another 6 months, if we wait another year, if we wait another 8 years. You know, 8 years at the present rate would be 400,000 deaths, 400,000 more deaths. That would be over 500,000 altogether. Is that what we want,
Michael,
like we did in Vietnam? Yes.
Michael Berg, what does it mean to run in the Green Party ticket now in Delaware? How are you a part of the political process? Do you have to gather signatures now? Are you a part of the debate?
No. No, I have not been required to gather signatures. The Green Party is on the ballot in the state of Delaware, which means I only had to win the approval of registered Greens in a caucus that we had on May the 13th. I am the nominee of the Green Party. All I have to do now is gather the votes and win.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Michael Berg, father of Nicholas Berg, beheaded in Iraq in May 2004. Michael Berg is now running for Congress on the Green Party ticket in Delaware. He's speaking to us from Wilmington. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by the Independent's Arun Gupta to talk about Zarqawi's death. Stay with us. Adel Salameh and Nazia Azouz here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To talk more about the impact of Zarqawi's death and what it will do to the Iraqi resistance and the ongoing war in Iraq, we're joined by Arun Gupta, an editor and reporter in New York for the newspaper The Independent. Welcome, Arun.
Thank you, Amy.
Your response.
Well, I think it's important to understand that Zarqawi's death may not diminish the resistance as the Bush administration hopes. It may, in fact, just end up doing the exact opposite, stoking the resistance. By way of analogy, I would point to the capture of Saddam Hussein in December of 2003. There was a lot of cheering back then from the Bush administration and supporters of war, saying that this was going to deal a mortal blow to the resistance. Now, of course, almost 2.5 years later after that, there's a lot less bombast from the Bush administration. They've declared victory about 10 different times now in Iraq, from mission accomplished to the elections, to the transfer of power, to the capture of Saddam Hussein. But when he was captured, you heard from a lot of Iraqis saying that this would actually increase the resistance to the occupation, because those who opposed the occupation could no longer be painted as Saddam loyalists. I think you may, in fact, see the same phenomena happen with the death of al-Zarqawi. He was someone who clearly did stoke sectarian war in Iraq. He did divide the nation. I think the sectarian, it's too late to put the genie back in the bottle of sectarianism and civil war. But there are a lot of resistance groups who were opposed to his strategy of attacking Shiites and Shiite monuments and places of significance, and they argued for more of a national religious struggle against the occupation. So I think you'll see those groups strengthen. And it's also important to understand that there are all sorts of networks. There's an insurgency of insurgencies within Iraq. There isn't one single group. There are many major networks, of which al-Qaeda was one of them. And according to research done by the Site Institute, what these networks would do is they would sponsor smaller groups. They would provide them with a certain amount of training, of funding, of weapons. They would promote their activities. And then the sponsoring network, like al-Qaeda or the Islamic Army, they would then put out the propaganda under their own name to make it appear that they had a broader reach. All these small groups, of which there may be hundreds, are not going to go away. They'll just find new sponsors. They'll continue their activity. And what we really have in place now is a whole nexus of wars. That's also very important to understand within Iraq, that there isn't just the counterinsurgency war and essentially a guerrilla resistance. We also have various sectarian wars between Shia and Sunni, between Arab and Kurd. There's also political struggles that are going on, open warfare like what's happening in Basra. You also have a dirty war going on, which the U.S. Deliberately stroked by organizing death squads in Iraq. You also have a tremendous amount of criminal activity, and none of this is going to go away.
What do you mean, death squads?
The U.S. in the fall of 2003, set up different units, initially grouped under the Special Police Commandos, which was a force of the Interior Ministry. And initially they were drawn from Baathist ex-Special Forces under Saddam Hussein, and they were armed and trained to essentially go after the insurgents and to kill people. And there's been a lot of evidence that they've been killing Sunni Arabs indiscriminately throughout Iraq. And the U.S. Armed them, they funded them, they trained them. And a lot of this is in U.S. government documents and Pentagon documents showing how they did this. And it was part of a deliberate strategy to try and break the back of the insurgency. It's called the Salvadorization of Iraq, referring to the use of death squads in El Salvador. It's similar to the Phoenix program that the U.S. Used during the Vietnam War to try and target those that it wasn't able to go after on the battlefield. The idea is that an indigenous security force is going to have better intelligence. But what happens is, you know, anyone who they capture is immediately guilty and they're indiscriminately killed. And this is one of the legacies that the U.S. has now left Iraq with. I think to a degree the death squads have spun out of U.S. control, but the U.S. is still also funding them, that this is something. There's a lot of argument, well, now that the Shiites are in control, now that they control the Interior Ministry, the Shiites are responsible for it. But again, if you go through the simple documentation, like these budget appropriation bills, who's providing these police units with their funding? Who's providing them with their weapons? Who's providing with their transportation, their communication, their bases? It's the U.S. government who's paying for it all. So the U.S. knows that this is going on, but they're using it as a tool because they think it's an effective way to suppress the insurgency. And to a degree, you can see in some areas where the resistance has been suppressed, but all that happens is they move on to a new area. The rate of U.S. deaths has really not diminished at all over the last 3 years, and that's despite the fact that the Pentagon has used virtually every weapon and tactic in its arsenal, has spent over $10 billion trying to create Iraqi security forces that are barely operational at best, and that has also resulted in the deaths of perhaps up to 200,000 Iraqi civilians and 2,700 foreign troops. And yet about 2 U.S. soldiers continue to die every day, indicating that the resistance is still resilient.
Arun Gupta, you've also been writing about the killings in Haditha in Ishaqi. Can you talk about your response?
Sure. I think it is important to understand that those are aberrations. What's really important to realize is that it obscures how the war itself is just an ongoing massacre. Most Iraqis are killed by bombings, coalition airstrikes, at checkpoints, in accidents, during raids. There isn't this deliberate campaign of U.S. troops going out and slaughtering Iraqi residents in their home. By focusing on this, it plays a certain convenient role for the Pentagon. It said they can say, well, these are the aberrations, just as in Abu Ghraib, that this is just a few bad apples, rather than dealing with the fact that the whole war itself is just one great massacre. Like I said, perhaps 200,000 Iraqi civilians have died. That comes from Les Roberts, who authored the Lancet study on increased mortality in Iraq in the fall of 2004. At that point, they came to a conclusion that 100,000 Iraqis had died with about a 95% certainty through a statistical sampling. This past February, before the outbreak of open civil war, he said 200,000 or more Iraqi civilians have died violent deaths. In the initial study, he said 80% had died from coalition airstrikes. So we have 80,000 Iraqi civilians, by this study's estimates, dying from coalition airstrikes in the first 18 months in the war. So what you have is incidents like Haditha and a related one in a village north of Baghdad, Ishaqi, are the aberrations. They are tragedies. They are war crimes. But we have to understand that the whole way the war is prosecuted is one ongoing war crime.
Well, Arun Gupta, I want to thank you very much for being with us, editor of The Independent in New York, and we will link to their website. In a related story, we turn now to what may have been one of the most controversial speeches at a college campus this spring. It occurred at the new school graduation ceremony here in New York, where Republican Senator John McCain gave the keynote address. McCain was invited to speak by new school president Bob Kerry, the former senator and longtime friend of McCain. Both supported the war. Nearly 1,000 people signed a petition urging Kerry to rescind McCain's invitation. The protests continued even at the graduation ceremony, when one of the student speakers directly confronted McCain over his support for the war. The student was Jean Sarah Rowe, 21-year-old graduate from New Jersey. She began her commencement address by singing a song.
If all the world were peaceful now and forevermore, peaceful at the surface and peaceful at the core, all the joy within my heart would be so free to soar. And we're living on a living planet, circling a living star. I don't know where we're going, but I know we're going far. We can change the universe by being who we are. And we're living on a living planet, circling a living star.
Welcome, everyone, on this beautiful afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. I only have 5 minutes, so I'd appreciate it if you'd... Thanks. Welcome, everyone, on this beautiful afternoon to the commencement ceremony for the new school class of 2006. That was an excerpt of a song I learned as a child called Living Planet by Jay Mankita. I chose to begin my address this way because, as always, but especially now, we are living in a time of violence, of war, of injustice. I am thinking of our brothers and sisters in Iraq, in Darfur, in Sri Lanka, in Mogadishu, in Israel, Palestine, right here in the United States, and many, many other places around the world. And my deepest wish on this day, on all days, is for peace, justice, and true freedom for all people. The song says, we can change the universe by being who we are. And I believe that it really is just that simple. Right now, I'm going to be who I am and digress from my previously prepared remarks that I had been working on for the past several weeks. I am disappointed that I have to abandon the things I had wanted to speak about, but I feel that it is absolutely necessary to acknowledge the fact that this ceremony has become something other than the celebratory gathering that it was intended to be due to all the media attention surrounding John McCain's presence here today and the student and faculty outrage generated by his invitation to speak. The senator does not reflect the ideals upon which this university was founded. Not only this, but his invitation was a top-down decision that did not take into account the desires and interests of the student body on an occasion that is supposed to honor us above all and to commemorate our achievements. What is interesting and bizarre about this whole situation is that Senator McCain has stated that he will be giving the same speech at all three universities where he has been invited to speak recently, of which ours is the last, those being Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, Columbia University, and finally, here at the New School. For this reason, I have unusual foresight concerning the themes of his address today. Based on the speech he gave at the other institution, Senator McCain will tell us today that dissent and disagreement are our civic and moral obligation in times of crisis. And I agree. I consider this a time of crisis, and I feel obligated to speak. Senator McCain will also tell us about his strong-headed self-assuredness in his youth, which prevented him from hearing the ideas of others. And in so doing, he will imply that those of us who are young are too naive to have valid opinions and open ears. I am young, and although I don't profess to possess the wisdom that time affords us, I do know that preemptive war is dangerous and wrong, that George Bush's agenda in Iraq is not worth the many lives lost. And I know that despite all the havoc that my country has wrought overseas, in my name, Osama bin Laden still has not been found, nor have those weapons of mass destruction. Finally, Senator McCain will tell us that we, those of us who are Americans, have nothing to fear from each other. I agree strongly with this, but I take it one step further. We have nothing to fear from anyone on this living planet. Fear is the greatest impediment to the achievement of peace. We have nothing to fear from people who are different from us, from people who live in other countries, even from the people who run our government. And this we should have learned from our educations here. We can speak truth to power. We can allow our humanity always to come before our nationality. We can refuse to let fear invade our lives and to goad us on to destroy the lives of others. These words I speak do not reflect the arrogance of a young, strong-headed woman, but belong to a line of great progressive thought, a history in which the founders of this institution play an important part. I speak today, even through my nervousness, out of a need to honor those voices that came before me, and I hope that we graduates can all strive to do the same. Thank you very much.
New school student Jean Sarah Rowe speaking at the university graduation ceremony just a few weeks ago. Soon after, Senator John McCain's chief of staff, Mark Salter, wrote a comment on the website HuffingtonPost.com attacking the student. Salter wrote, quote, "The only person you've succeeded in making look like an idiot is yourself," he wrote. He went on to tell the student protesters, quote, "You might look back on the day of your graduation and your discourtesy to a good and honest man with a little shame and the certain knowledge that it will very likely any one of you will ever possess the one small fraction of the character of John McCain." Well, yesterday, the House voted on legislation that could determine the future of the internet and public access television in this country. In a vote of 321 to 101, the House voted to pass the COPE bill, the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act. This controversial telecommunications legislation would permit phone and cable companies to operate internet and other digital communication services, private networks, free of policy safeguards or government oversight. The bill effectively ends what's known as net neutrality, which is the concept that everyone, everywhere should have free, universal, and non-discriminatory access to the internet. The bill also cuts back the obligation of cable TV companies to devote channels to public access and fund the facilities that run them. And the COPE bill replaces local cable franchises with national franchises. Democratic Massachusetts Congress member Ed Markey had proposed an amendment to the COPE bill that would have included stiff net neutrality regulations and prevented broadband providers from treating some internet sites differently from others, but the amendment was rejected. This is Congressman Markey speaking from the House floor yesterday.
Let me just make it once again. The Bell companies had nothing to do with the creation of the internet. The Bell companies had nothing to do with the development of the World Wide Web. The Bell companies had nothing to do with the browser and its development. In fact, AT&T was asked if they wanted to build the internet, the packet switch network, in 1966. They turned the contract down when the government went to them. And so a company named BBNN, both Beranek and Newman, got the contract. A very small company, not AT&T. They've had nothing to do with the development of the internet, but now, at this late date, they want to come in and to create these bottleneck control points that allow them to extract internet taxes, internet fees from companies and individuals who have been using the internet for a generation. It is this absence of non-discriminatory language in the manager's amendment and in the bill to which I object.
Democratic Massachusetts Congressmember Ed Markey speaking from the House floor yesterday. Opposition to the COPE bill came from all corners. The Save the Internet Coalition, representing musicians, special interest groups, bloggers, and others, delivered almost 800,000 petition signatures to Congress in favor of net neutrality. Internet companies have also spoken out against provisions in the bill. Sergey Brin, the co-founder of the search engine Google, met with members of the Commerce Committee to explain the importance of net neutrality for promoting internet commerce. And the CEO of eBay, Meg Whitman, took the unusual step of personally emailing the auction site's users to ask their support for promoting net neutrality protections. eBay stated the email reached over 1 million users. We're joined now in the studio by Anthony Riddle. He's the executive director of the Alliance for Community Media. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
So, is net neutrality over?
No, I'd say that we're halfway to the apocalypse right now. There's been a fairly bad bill for the internet and for public media that has gone through the House. It's the COPE Act, and it was passed in the dead of night last night, 3-1 margin, and effectively it continues the sort of decision that was made by the Supreme Court last year in August, which changed the internet fundamentally. Before that time, it was understood that all data on the internet was to be treated equally and that nobody was to block any information going from anyone to anyone. With the Supreme Court decision and last night's bill, the companies that operate the wires or fibers that bring the internet to and from your house have the ability to offer preferential treatment for pay and also to block any content that they deem opposing their business interests.
So users already pay internet
yes.
service per month. So this does the other end, the content providers, people who put up websites would also have to pay?
No, they actually pay already now. You know, if you have a website, you have to pay for space on the website, and you have to pay for a pipeline for people to reach it, and however big that pipeline is for people to come to your website, that determines how many people can access your web streams or whatever. So people are paying on both ends already. What they're trying to do right now is get people to pay for the middle so that you can pay for an easy pass lane if you're Disney and you have a lot of money, and if you don't, then you're going to have to sit in the long lines waiting to go through the toll booth.
Is the Senate going to approve this kind of bill?
There's a set of bills in the Senate that are very similar. There's some differences or whatever. What the Senate will have to do is pass a bill, and then the two houses will have to get together and do what they call conference committee. And since both of those houses are controlled by the same party, with large majorities, they can actually change the bills in toto in this conversation. They don't have to stick to the bills that were actually passed. They can add anything or take anything out as long as both houses agree.
So what is your hope for the Senate?
This is what I hope. What I hope is that the people who are within the range of this program and all over the United States will check in on this matter. This is of vital importance. We need every kind of community organization that is organized to check in and say that they oppose the internet being controlled the way that it's being proposed to be controlled, and that public media like PEG, Public Educational Government Access, needs to have the kind of funding that it's had and that it needs to survive, that we need to be able to have the kind of channel capacity that we need in the future, because this bill is really for the long-distant future.
Now, these are two separate issues. One is net neutrality in the internet, and the other is public access and saving it. And they're together in the COPE bill or whatever version
yes.
also will be the Senate. So what has happened with access now? You were protesting at Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee's offices.
Well, there was an amendment added to the COPE Act at the last minute, which would have allowed half of public access funding to be taken to provide an incentive for women and minority owners of small cable systems, which is really a good issue. And it was well intended, but I think Jackson Lee didn't quite understand what was at stake, that public access, for instance, has the most female subject, female run, produced programming, the most managers, the same with minorities, that there's a lot of, this is where we go, to get our message out because we can't get it out anywhere. And when she understood that, she very graciously agreed to withdraw the bill with the idea that Congressman Markey and Dingell and some of the others would help to address this issue in a different way. But we averted losing half of PEG funding just last night, just before the vote.
You were in the gallery when Markey was making his statement
yes.
and the vote.
Yes, he made a very impassioned statement. It was really good. It's such a contrast to see Markey making this statement about freedom and understanding and how people ought to be able to interact, and then to see the other side making these impassioned pleas that we should pass this bill because what the American people need is $20 off of their cable TV bill.
Well, wasn't it Mike McCurry, the former spokesperson for President Clinton, who really was the front man, the spokesperson for the key lobbyist for a kind of AstroTurf campaign where progressive bloggers had ads on their websites that said, stop government interference or regulation of the internet.
This is yeah, you're right. And this is like 1984. If they're saying stop government interference, what they really mean is we want interference. It's just like the Clean Air Act.
Corporate interference.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been amazing. You know, I've known how the government ran for a long time, but I never really understood the power of money. In California, where there's a similar bill being offered at the state level, the telephone company bought every single lobbyist in the state. When the Cable Television Association went to get a lobbyist, there was not a lobbyist to be found, not even for them. You know, when we talk about over on the Hill, Verizon had over 200 lobbyists just on this bill. You know, and that's not even talking about AT&T. They've bought every single person that can.
Do you think this is payoff to the telecoms for cooperating with the government and the NSA and handing over the phone logs of tens of millions of Americans?
Hey, I don't want to sound cynical, but I think that's absolutely what happened. I think, you know, the government goes and they say, you know, we've got this massive legislation that's really important to you. This is what you really want. You wrote it. We can pass it. This is what we need of you. And you bring up a really good point, because what we're talking about is handing over the complete communication system to people who have no regard for your privacy, who will hand stuff over without warrants or anything. I think people really need to be up in arms
about
this.
When does the Senate vote?
We keep hearing different things. It's hard to tell. I know that they all want to get out before summer starts so that they can get back in campaign, because it's campaign season. But if the people check in really, really heavily on net neutrality, on public access.
Where do they find out information?
They can go to the Alliance website, which is www.alliancecm.org. They can go to saveaccess.org, and they can also go to the Free Press site, which is Save the Internet. We implore all organizations. We've even got the Christian Coalition and the NRA involved in this, because everybody understands that if you have anything that's remotely not mainstream, that this can be blocked if these measures go through.
Anthony Riddle, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the Alliance for Community Media. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A senior member of the Hamas government was assassinated in an Israeli airstrike in the Gaza town of Rafah on Thursday. Three of his bodyguards were also killed in the attack. The government official, Interior Ministry General Director Jamal Abu Samad Hadana, was also a founding member of the Popular Resistance Committees that had been accused of plotting attacks inside Israel. Sam Hadana had narrowly escaped four previous assassination attempts. Earlier that day, three Palestinians were shot dead near a border crossing in the Gaza Strip. Israel said its troops had opened fire on, quote, three suspect silhouettes moving towards the border. Palestinians said the dead were policemen on patrol. Meanwhile, Palestinian officials are having talks over a peace plan by the Palestinian Authority president that implicitly recognizes Israel. President Mahmoud Abbas has given Hamas until Saturday to accept the 18-point plan, or he'll put it to a referendum. This comes as the Bush administration has canceled international talks that were expected to lead to emergency payments of salaries for Palestinian workers. Thousands of Palestinian government employees have gone without pay following an international aid freeze on the Hamas-led government. A European diplomat told the Independent of London the cancellation stoking fears the U.S. government's committed to, quote, regime change in the occupied territories. For more on the latest, we're joined in our Firehouse studio by Leila El-Haddad, a Palestinian journalist and mother who lives in Gaza, as well as the United States. She writes for AlJazeera.net and other publications. She maintains her own blog titled Raising Youssef, a Diary of a Mother Under Occupation. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Your response to the latest killings?
I mean, it's just unreal to me that, given the current situation and given the tension and given everything that's going on and the continued closures and the asphyxiation of the economy, that, you know, Israel again would go to these lengths and to assassinate, you know, Samhadana, who, in addition to being the head of the Popular Resistance Committees, was the new PA security chief. And it was sort of seen as an effort to rein in all of the different armed groups because he was a very influential figure. And it was seen that he could, you know, kind of bring them all under his umbrella. So, you know, this is just going to further escalate tensions within Gaza. And the security situation is going to further deteriorate, and of course that being directly linked with the humanitarian situation.
And Israel saying that he was responsible for attacks inside Israel?
Right, as the head of the Popular Resistance Committee is, you know, considered to be someone who spearheaded a lot of resistance attacks.
Can you talk about what's happening in Gaza right now?
The situation is very, very difficult, you know, and it predates the current government. It's important to remind that since the disengagement from Gaza in the summer of 2006, when Israel withdrew its troops and settlers from Gaza, the situation has been continuously deteriorating because everything continues to be under Israeli control. We've heard it time and again, but Gaza literally has become more of a prison than it was before, very much an open-air prison with the skies and the air and the borders and the permit registry system very significantly still controlled by Israel. And that means that no one can leave or come into Gaza unless they have an Israeli-issued Palestinian ID card. So many families, including my own, not able to unite within Gaza because one or the other lacks the ID card and doesn't have a family reunification. And more significantly, we can't go to the West Bank. Before, it was very difficult to obtain a permit. Now it's pretty much next to impossible for Palestinians to commute between Gaza and the West Bank. So really, just Gaza completely now cut off from the world and from the West Bank and from Israel. And with the continued economic closures, as you mentioned, of the Karni and Mintad crossing, which has been closed 50% of the year, completely asphyxiating the economy, hundreds of thousands of tons of vegetables and fruits that were supposed to be exported and help the economy stay afloat, rotted.
How do you get around? Are you together with your family?
My husband is a refugee from a Palestinian refugee who lives in Lebanon. He's also a physician. He works in this country. He still has a refugee permit. He can't come join me in Gaza, so I commute with our 2-year-old son, Yusuf, after which my blog is named, back and forth between Gaza and the United States.
And how hard or easy is it for you to get in and out?
I'm just like any other Palestinian. I have a Palestinian Authority passport, and that's significant. We always say it's not a Palestinian passport because we're still not recognized, you know, as a people, as a state, as a nationality. And this is significant because of all of the talk about referendum and recognizing Israel. And I go on that Palestinian Authority passport and on my Israeli-issued ID card. And I've added my son to that ID card so he can have that right to go back and forth with me. And we travel through the Rafah crossing, which is the only exit and entry point into and out of the Gaza Strip and continues to be effectively controlled by Israel. While they don't no longer physically man it, they still control who goes in and out and monitor it by video surveillance.
You were in Rafah during the first and second Israeli incursions there?
Yes. Yes, in the fall of 2003 and then again in the spring of 2004. Both times I was just arriving. Once I was pregnant and the second time my son was just 2 months old. And, you know, Israel had just raided the camp for several days, put it under complete lockdown. Very, very few journalists, I should add, were actually there or even bothered to go and just did sort of the aftermath color shot. And, you know, it's difficult to kind of give any kind of snapshot of the devastation that was wreaked there. And, you know, it was all the more senseless because a lot of the house demolition that occurred there, you know, 2/3 of the houses that were demolished in Palestine were done so in Rafah. 16,000 people lost their homes, just to give you a scale, the enormity of the house demolition. And much of it happened just prior to the disengagement, which made it all the more senseless.
How do you think this all is being conveyed in the media, and especially since you've got your feet in both worlds there
yeah.
and here,
yeah.
how it's covered here?
Very poorly, to put it bluntly. I mean, I'm constantly surprised. People tell me you shouldn't be, but I am at how little people know about. I know it's difficult to get a grasp of all of these details, but they're so significant because I call them part of the Israeli matrix of control that fall under this rubric of occupation that really just invades the very private lives of Palestinians and destroys everything. And it's not conveyed. I mean, the focus is, you know, I can sum it up. I call it copy and paste journalism done by parachute journalists. It's, you know, Hamas, the militant group dedicated to the destruction of Israel, and that's all we hear, you know, or gunmen have been fighting or rockets have been fired. But you don't hear anything about, you know, Gaza's 1.5 million Palestinians that are just under lockdown now. You know, the fact that the closures have been, the crossings have been closed 50% of the year. The fact that, as you mentioned, 150,000 government employees, they're not getting their salaries. They support one-third of the Palestinian population.
You as a woman?
You know, it's much more difficult being a journalist as a woman and also being a mother and also being a Palestinian. That's all in one package. And someone once asked me, how can you be objective, you know, being Palestinian and that it affects you so personally? And I like to draw on the wonderful Amira Haas, and someone once asked her that, and she said there's a difference between being objective and being fair.
We're talking to Leila El-Haddad. She keeps a blog called Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation, and works for AlJazeera.net. Your response to Abbas's proposal for a referendum?
I mean, the timing isn't the greatest to kind of force this referendum in such a difficult time and situation, and when there is no acknowledgement of Palestinian rights, of Palestinian right to exist, and there never has been, and no such, you know, absolutely unheard of conditions imposed on Israel for denying Palestinian rights and continuing the occupation. I think it's a mistake for him to do it at this time, and especially do it so publicly, especially since the current government has indicated, you know, that it's not its decision to make this decision to recognize Israel's right to exist. It's a decision for all the Palestinian people, implying that referendum would be the answer. But it's a matter of timing. And, you know, recently I did a photo story speaking with 9 Palestinians about this issue of recognition. And time and again, what I heard from them was just this, that, you know, this is, look what 10 years of negotiation has brought us, yes after yes after yes, and this will just be another yes that's going to result in nothing but more devastation. And, you know, they said, in the context of a comprehensive and just solution with reciprocated rights, you know, it makes sense, but now it just doesn't.
And the Israeli Prime Minister Olmert's proposal for redrawing the borders, a unilateral proposal.
Right. We were joking about how, what's the new phrase that he's come up with? Convergence? I don't know. But, I mean, I call it the annexation plan because that's what it is. It's destroying the West Bank. It's chopping it into 3 parts and annexing large portions of it. And within those 3 parts, 9 separate cantons just divided and riddled with checkpoints and all sorts of other things that just really destroy Palestinian life in every way. And it's also going to destroy any hope of any kind of just solution or negotiated settlement and render a Palestinian state completely impossible.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Leila El-Haddad, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian journalist and mother living in Gaza, as well as here. She writes for AlJazeera.net, maintains her own blog, Raising Yusuf, a diary of a mother under occupation. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, and Samantha Chamblee. We also want to wish our TV graphic designer, Chris Zucker, a very happy future, a fond farewell to him. He's worked with us for 3 years, as well as a very happy birthday. And we thank him for all that he has done for Democracy Now! Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.